It was known as the wickedest town in the West. Come with us now as we explore the historic ghost town of Jerome, Arizona. Hello and welcome to Midwest Ghost Town Season 2, Episode 12, The Wickedest Town in the West, Jerome, Arizona. This is Dan, I'm your host, history enthusiast, ghost town adventurer, and storyteller. Today we're taking you outside the Midwest and into the mountain region of northern Arizona, 5,240 feet above sea level to be exact, and approximately 100 miles from Phoenix, and in between Sedona, Arizona, and Prescott, Arizona, to a place nestled right next to the Mingus Mountains. Welcome to Jerome, Arizona. An old copper mining town turned historic ghost town, which we will get more into the backstory here in a minute, but first, full detail on what we are discussing today, how this whole two-part series came about, and where this will be taking us. Long story short, we're discussing Jerome because it is one of those stories that ghost town legends, especially as we get into stories of old mining towns and the stories of the West, come alive. Jerome, in one way or another, might not be considered a ghost town. In 2022, it was reported to have a population of 465 people, a far cry from its mining heyday of over 15,000. But Jerome began marketing itself as the world's largest ghost city, or the largest ghost town in America, around 1953, and has never looked back. It's historic in all sense of the word, but some might not claim it entirely as a classic ghost town only because it doesn't hold true to population zero. But nevertheless, under the 10% ratio from its high point, making it what I like to call a living ghost town. We'll get into the history and the stories of Jerome, but I believe when I say what a story it has. Ghost stories mainly, but plenty of history to go along with it. So, we'll start there. But second, this whole thing came about because I was having a talk with one of my good friends, Jim, and Jim was a former resident of Jerome, so I thought this would be a great time to go into some other ghost towns outside the Midwest for a few weeks and lead into a second part of this podcast on Jerome, Arizona, down the road here. Followed up with an interview with Jim. That's going to be coming next week. But now I'm sure some of you might not remember who Jim is, and I think this is a great place to talk about one of my first videos I did on my YouTube channel where I featured Jim talking with me about a pioneer cemetery we have in O'Brien County, Iowa. We were discussing the Great Grasshopper Plague, Rocky Mountain Locust, if you want the actual name, where they literally blotted out the sun, plagued the farm fields in the Midwest and the Plain States, destroying crops and devastating the livelihood of many. Laura Ingalls Wilder even alludes to it in her stories, Little House on the Prairie, but Jim is what I like to call a Renaissance man. He's a woodworker, furniture craftsman, coffee house owner, barista extreme, and upcoming author with a vast knowledge of pioneer history and history surrounding the Sioux uprising in the upper Midwest, mainly around Inkpaduta and the Spirit Lake Massacre. He's an interesting character and friend. So in part two, we'll dive into Jim's story in Jerome, Arizona. That'll be coming next week. And last but not least, this will lead us to discover a couple other historic ghost towns in the Southwest for a couple of weeks as well, before returning back to the Midwest. Let's get into the story of Jerome, Arizona. The land around what was known as the Verde was in the middle of war, and not a war that is often told and retold into Northern and Southern American history as the American Civil War, a war that overshadowed most conflicts in American history at the time, but a lesser known war, one fought in the American Southwest between 1849 and 1886, one that involved a tribal people fighting the Mexican government and later the United States over its land. The Apache were seen as enemies, a tribe often considered through history as savage and violent. Stories of villages and pioneers killed, but the truth was a tribe that raided for generations to protect their land and their people. The story of Jerome in this case starts here. Because of the Apache conflict, it brought infamous scouting legend Al Sieber into the area. As a wounded veteran in the Civil War, he came to the area to scout the Apaches for the army, but continued his venture as a promising prospector. It was during one of these scouting events that he discovered the old native mining grounds of the Verde area and immediately staked claim to the area. The land was rich with copper, but Sieber didn't completely grasp what he had a hold of with his claim and later sold. There were countless other prospectors drawn to the area, but it wasn't until New York financial giant Eugene Jerome was convinced to be an investor in the mining town that Jerome fully began its mining venture. He eventually invested $200,000, and the town was named in his honor. Founded in 1876, Jerome went through mining gains and losses, but it finally hit its breakthrough about 7 years later when local miners discovered a large vein of silver, valued around $80,000. But Jerome was too far away from any realistic transporting solution, and the cost of freight brought Jerome to its near end. 5 years later, the slight discoveries of ore in the area piqued the interest of Phelps Dodge, who sent another brilliant mining expert, Dr. James Douglas, to make an offer to Jerome, who was asking about $300,000 to make up for his initial investment. Douglas offered $30,000 and was quickly turned down. The bidding war had begun, and this is when William Andrews Clark literally stole the opportunity right beneath Dodge's nose. No one saw another interested party coming into play, especially since the mine hadn't produced, and this cost Phelps Dodge. Clark was a Montana mining man, and he believed that the answer to the area was the higher ground near the mountainside, known as Cleopatra Hill. He met Jerome's asking price of $300,000, trying to counter this action. Douglas went back to meet the same price, but he was too late. The mine was sold, and Clark went to establish the United Verde Copper Company, a company that eventually made $1 billion in gold, silver, and copper. And Jerome came to life. From the very start, Jerome put the word wild into the West. And the Wild West was exactly what Jerome had become. A town of only a few hundred began to boom into thousands, and prospectors and miners came to strike it rich. There was little to be said about law enforcement or building codes, and chaos surrounding gambling disputes, gunfights, and saloon drunkenness eventually led to three different fires within 18 months burning down the town. Mining explosions and accidents were common. There was one story of the mine shafts collapsing and killing several men. A recount of the fire history. The 1894 fire destroyed 12 buildings. 2 months later, a second fire burned the rest of the downtown. Christmas, 1897, burned down a brothel, four saloons, and a boarding house. And later the following fall, another fire. Phoenix newspapers would dub this one the fiery breath that blew Jerome off the face of the earth. It was later reported that 8 people had burned to death. And finally, in May of 1899, the Leland Hotel caught fire, spread to downtown and burned one of the local hospitals, saloons, stores, restaurants, a blacksmith, barbershop, and bowling alley. Dozens of dwellings were turned into ash. But the fires didn't stop Jerome. They went on to rebuild each time and eventually adopted a new fire code, brick to replace wood and concrete and other projects. Fireproofing was underway. But Jerome grew even more wild, which filled its reputation as a miner's town. Wild with gambling, wild with drinking, wild with other additions like opium dens, wild with violence and fighting, gunfights, brawls, and the second largest employer after the United Verde Mining Company were the brothels. The business of sex. It was said that there were easily over 100 prostitutes that worked in an area known as the Crib District, a place formed because they didn't want prostitution run out into the open and on Main Street, so they hid it behind in the shadows and the unseen. The Crib District, almost like a red light district and nicknamed Husband's Alley. prostitutes would often see 30 to 80 clients a day. They were often victims to violence and crime, and there was one story of one of the most popular and beautiful workers in town who was later found dead in her room, strangled to death by a client. But essentially, the women were strictly property to the madams who owned them, who ran the business of the brothel. All of this earned Jerome a reputation. The New York Sun called it the wickedest town of the West. Not to be undone, the San Francisco Examiner one-upped the Sun and called Jerome the wickedest town in America. And we're about to learn just how wicked Jerome would become right after this. Hi there, Dan here. Thank you for following along with the podcast or any of our videos on our YouTube page. We consider ourselves here a community, so I appreciate the support, the follows, and the likes, and even the constructional criticism. I might know a few things about history, but I don't have to know it all. That's where some of you might come in handy. If you have a thought, a suggestion, or even a tip or two pointing in that direction of a ghost town or an abandoned place or two, and a story to go along with it, I'd love to hear from you. I'll give you full credit and mention along with the recording and production and consider it a partnership in keeping history alive. You can always reach me at my email, which is midwestghosttown@gmail.com. That's midwestghosttown@gmail.com. And with that, a quick message from one of the listeners. I had a request to dive into the history of a town in Carroll County, Iowa. Lexington, Iowa, to be exact. More research to follow on this one, but I'll tell the listener now. Just a quick search has Lexington in two different counties in Iowa, Taylor and Washington County. Though there were several other notable ghost towns in Carroll County, we can do some more research on this one and get more information leading into another Iowa ghost town. And we're covering lots of different stories here. One coming up is Rubel, Iowa. I have the opportunity to travel with one of my listeners and fellow YouTuber, Rural Adventurer, who has been doing extensive research and work with ghost towns in Plymouth, Iowa. We just got permission to do some footage on that property, so looking forward to this. And in the meantime, I'll get to work on Lexington. There appears to be some interesting stuff out there, a cemetery linked to both locations, a famous historical stagecoach stop, it looks like, which now functions as the Lexington Inn. And there's more to come on this as we work to keep history alive. Welcome back. We've been covering some of the bad things happening in Jerome and labeling it the most wickedest town in the West. And in truth, it actually earned itself a couple of titles from both major newspapers in the East and one in the West. And the title really isn't a glamorous one. It's basically flat out saying Jerome is a low, crime-ridden, dirty, rotten place. And to get more specific, wicked. And it was pointed out wickedness in a multitude of different ways, but just how wicked is the question. Some of the key madams who came to Jerome to run their brothels are listed. Nora Butter Brown, the first madam, she was said to be notoriously ugly in appearance and was even proud of the fact, as she was quoted as saying to would-be customers, "I know I'm not much to look at, boys, but wait until you see the girls. You're gonna love them." Then there was Jenny Banter, infamous for her business skills in Jerome and becoming the richest woman in northern Arizona. And of course, there were numerous other madams to follow, including names like Cuban Mary, Rose Lily, and Madam Pearl. There was a history to Jerome surrounding prostitution for sure, but there was another story that caught my attention while researching the town, its history, legends, and stories, one ultimately linked between three main characters. Madam Nora Butter Brown, Wyatt Earp, and Billy the Kid. Author William Wingfield wrote a small piece about a time when all three characters crossed paths. Now, some have said it was legend, but this piece written by Wingfield claims that it's true. Here's a quick retelling of the story written by Wingfield in the setting of the saloon run by Nora Butter Brown, an account where Nora herself identifies both Earp and the Kid during an interview in 1903 in her home in San Diego. Nora goes on to tell the story. "You remembers how we was drinking that night? Well, come along sometime after dark. The first of them walks in. He's got that long drover's coat on, all dusty and all from the road, and he kind of joins in with us, tipping the bottle. Being young as he was, he could sure hold his liquor. Seemed the drunker he got, the funnier he was. All the boys liking him right away, said his name was Henry. Said he just delivered some cattle from New Mexico territory to Old Boss Head down in the valley, and heard there was a cat house going up at the camp, so he had to check it out for himself. He wasn't a big fella. He was actually kind of funny looking, but there was something about him. On one hand, he got along with the boys right away, laughing and joking and such. But on the other hand, there was something there that made you not want to get on his bad side. He carried two Colt 41s, and their holsters hung backwards on the side of each hip. Hadn't ever seen anyone carry guns like that. And they was slung low and tied down on his thigh. You just had the feeling that he could make those Colts jump into his hands like pet rattlesnakes. You know, that was before all the dime novel stuff glamorizing with all the hoochie-coo on handsome romantic outlaws and such. It was all new to me. What did I know? I just trying to make my way. You know how it was. As I was saying, we was all getting along famously, talking big about how he was going to do all kind of grand things, when all of a sudden, the second outsider came in. Now, he was a fella, whole different stripe. Tall, thin, quiet. Came in wearing one of those flat brims so to keep the rain off you and such. Had these tall leather boots, the ones that came up to your knees. Black they was. I remember being struck by the idea he was a city fella. He had on a striped vest and that gold watch chain stretched from his pocket to the other pocket, and he was carrying a Colt strapped to his side like old Henry. Except he only had one hung the normal way, and he seemed like he was shy about it. He tended to keep it covered by his long coat. So he comes in, he sits at the table across the room from the bar, quiet-like. Of course, I go right over and starts talking to him, took a bottle of rye and a couple of glasses with me, and I thought, maybe because of the way he was dressed, that he might have some money to spend on a lady. Seemed like a good way to christen my house, you know? Nora goes on to explain that the stranger wasn't interested in anything romantic. But notice that the younger stranger, Henry, was very curious and walks over to the table with a big smile and joins them. Is it a private party or can a friendly stranger join in? Now my eyes went back to the older gentleman and watched him size up the younger Henry. I could tell he was measuring him, how it would be toe to toe. His gaze lingers on the other man's Colts, colder eyes I'd never seen. Danny smiles just a little and says, "Have a seat, cowboy. I'll buy you a drink." The young man pulls up a chair, helps himself to a drink right out of the bottle on the table, smiling all the while as he fills up in old cold eyes, glass as he starts to talk. "Why, you look like a man who's taking a wrong turn somewhere. Look like you maybe ought to be dealing faro in some fancy saloon in Dodge, or Abilene, or somewhere like that. Look a little high tone for this place." And then my man looks at him a second and says, "Just passing through, son. On my way to Tombstone to join my family." "Ever been to Dodge?" asked the kid. And the man looked at him and says, "I've been there. You know, I was in Dodge once. I think maybe I saw you there." And right there he reaches his hand across the table, offering it for a shake. "My name's Henry McCarty, but my friends call me Billy." Right then, my man reaches his hand and says,
"Wyatt. Wyatt Earp."
Well, at this point, the smile on the young fellow's face just gets bigger. And he says, "Tell you the truth, Mr. Earp, I knew that. Saw you draw down on four drunks some night in Dodge. Never seen anyone draw and shoot as fast as you. It was quite a sight. And it made me wonder." Now, at this point, I begin to get a little lightheaded. We had all heard of Wyatt Earp, the Dodge City Peace Commission, Bat Masterson, Wyatt was a legend even then, and I was catching my breath. I noticed that neither man was speaking. They was just looking at each other.
What's it make you wonder, Mr. McCarty?
And the whole time, without taking his eyes off Wyatt, he says, "Well, makes me wonder, who's faster with his gun, me or Wyatt Earp?" Wyatt's all calm and slow. He takes a small drink of his whiskey.
"You don't have to do this, son,"
he says all quiet-like. "I tell you, both men seemed like they was spring-loaded, all coiled up, ready to explode." "Oh, I don't know, Mr. Earp. I think I just might have to," says Henry, still smiling, all to beat hell. "And who knows what might have happened next if he hadn't heard all the gunfire and yelling."
Now, according to the story, Nora recounts that someone ran in yelling that Apaches were stealing all the horses, and everyone went out running into the street. And the story goes on.
Wyatt is as cool as a man on a Sunday promenade. His pistol comes out of nowhere, and he's about to start heading out to the street when suddenly the kid puts a cocked Colt to Wyatt's ear. "Just move real slow there, Mr. Earp. That's it. Easy does it."
Now, as he's talking, he's reaching for Wyatt's gun.
"I'll be relieving you of the nice peacemaker you got there."
And then he sticks Wyatt's pistol in the waistband of his breeches. Nora goes on to explain that 4 to 5 Indians rode up, rifles ready, covering the crowd, and that Billy was in working with them stealing horses.
"I was so scared at that moment, I actually wet myself," I heard old Henry shout out to Wyatt as he was leaving with the other horse thieves. "Maybe some other day, Mr. Earp. Once I get paid for these horses, maybe I'll look you up in Tombstone. How'd that be?"
And that was funny because Wyatt all of a sudden says back, "Be my pleasure, Henry."
And the whole time, Wyatt never showed one whit of emotion. And as he's riding away on the stolen horse, he yells back, "Billy, my friends call me Billy."
Now, naturally, we know that this could easily be the stuff of legends, made up stories, fiction to pass the time or to bring the crowds. More on this shortly, but it's written that author William Wingfield lived to be 92, dying in his sleep in 1951, and stressed to readers, "Butter said it was true, and I believed her." How about you? Do you believe Nora Butter Brown, or just a lofty tale of the Old West? More on the wickedest town in the West right after this. Hey there, Ghost Town and history enthusiast Dan here with Midwest Ghost Town. I wanted to first say thank you for following along. We consider ourselves a community here on the podcast channel and website. There's multiple ways to listen, whether you listen on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast, YouTube, as well as our website, MidwestGhostTown.com. I always love hearing from you as well, which you can reach us at MidwestGhostTown@gmail.com. But as a community, I always love giving shout-outs to others that I network with along the way. Ones I work with, find encouragement with, and I want to point out another podcast. Carolina Ghost Towns, plural. Carolina Ghost Towns. This is an exceptional history podcast over ghost towns, mainly in the Carolina states, but I love Tom's attention to detail and his storytelling and ability to keep history alive. You know what? He's a lot like me in that sense, and I just want to give him some love on this channel. Consider checking him out, subscribing. We know there are thousands of ghost towns worldwide, and just hearing the stories from others makes the work that more enjoyable. Thanks, Tom, and keep up the good work. Once again, that's Carolina Ghost Towns. Let's keep history alive. I'll cut to chase on this last segment of the podcast. All of the history, the violence, death, scandals, corruption, and the fitting of the nickname the Wickedest Town in the West points to Jerome being haunted. Well, at least hundreds of different stories from people would lead you to believe that. I'm not a ghost or a paranormal channel, so I won't dive too deep on this subject. Well, maybe just a few of the famous ghost stories, but not too deep. You can literally Google Jerome, Arizona, And there are endless stories, websites, podcasts, videos out there, all shining a light on the paranormal and haunted side of Jerome. I'll let those channels do its justice, as I know they will do a much better job in that niche and genre. But you can't go to Jerome and miss out on these stories or numerous ghost tours in the town. It certainly fits the narrative of the most wicked. In fact, it reminds me of a story of when I was in San Antonio a few years ago. I was staying at the Davy Crockett Hotel, which sits directly behind the Alamo, and I was noticing numerous different ghost tours around the Riverwalk and Alamo area, and as I was checking out for the night, I asked the hotel receptionist about it, and she looked at me in this weird way, almost like, duh, and says, well, 150 years ago, there was a major battle that occurred where you're standing. Actually, all around this place, over 1,000 Mexican troops and nearly 200 Texans died during the Battle of the Alamo. Do you think that maybe these grounds might be haunted? So, thought that was kind of an interesting thing, and so here I am now. Great question. I'm not a huge believer in all that, but I'm not here to debate. And I did think she had a valid point in terms of the amount of violence that occurred on the grounds and the stories that were forever linked to it. Stories of Davy Crockett, famous frontiersman, James Bowie, inventor of the Bowie knife, and the Alamo leader William Travis all cemented the tale, some legend, of the famous battle. And now the battle site that gave the famous battle cry of Texas independence. Remember the Alamo. This is like Jerome, only the story centered around the wickedness and the violence and death occurring in the town and giving rise to ghost stories. Some of these fall along infamous Husband's Alley, where certain ghost prostitutes haunt the old crib district, and of course the numerous hotels that carry the same paranormal attention. I'll go ahead and I'll mention three. The Connor Hotel, the Mile High Inn, which is along Husband's Alley, and the most notorious of all, and also considered the most haunted in the state of Arizona, number three, the Jerome Grand Hotel. Some of these stories point back to some of the Madam characters I was talking about before, but mainly surrounding Jenny Bender, haunting the Mile High Inn. Even though she was murdered in a different town, it is said that her spirit still lurks around the inn. There is also a story of a phantom cat that leaves paw prints on the beds to be seen, or the feeling of it brushing up against the legs of visitors. There's another story that follows more along the tragedy that existed among miners, the fact that any day, an explosion or mining accident could easily take their life. And this is precisely what surrounds the story of Charlie, or Headless Charlie, to the locals. A mining accident took the miner's life, and they were able to recover his body, but found that he had been decapitated. They searched for his head, but they never found it. The ghost story of Headless Charlie follows the ghost searching restlessly for his head through the mine shafts beneath Jerome. Story after story exists. If this is your thing, you can check it out online. All sorts of different places, tours, and stories exist surrounding the historic ghost town of Jerome. But as we focus on ghost towns here, let's talk about Jerome as a ghost town. It was obviously booming at one point, recording over 15,000 living in the town at its highest point. The years went by, the mines active between 1876 and the 1950s, and they were able to mine 33 million tons of gold, silver, copper, zinc, and lead ore, bringing an overall value worth $1 billion. And by 1953, as the ore began to run out, the United Verde mine closed. There were fewer than 100 by the mid-1950s, and Jerome started to erode to an Arizona ghost town. And this is where it all began to change for Jerome. The remaining citizens of Jerome understood that they needed to embrace their history and market themselves differently to draw a different group of people besides miners to its town. They needed tourists. And so the Jerome Historical Society began referring to the town as the largest ghost town in the United States. By the end of the 1950s, the population doubled and had around 250 people. Then it doubled again, reaching around 500. Stories of ghosts began to be told, and it's not hard to imagine that the stories and History of Jerome catapulted it to one of the highest-grossing counties for tourism. In all senses of the word, Jerome is a living ghost town. They are operating around 10% mark from where it once stood with its highest population. In the 70s and 80s, Jerome saw another resurging interest, and that was with artists. It became an area where people wanted to explore, and the wickedest town in the West began to shine, began to embrace its past, present, and future. Not only as the largest ghost town in America, but a living ghost town, historical, artistic, with lively stories and beautiful surroundings to make it worth visiting. The mystery of Jerome is answered by walking its streets, exploring the different buildings, structures, and museums, hearing the countless stories, both haunted and historical. A true Wild West town. Along the mountainside of northern Arizona, a mining camp turned town, turned boom, then bust. The rough and the tough stories of its wild past. Jerome, Arizona, the wickedest town in the West. Let's keep history alive. This is Midwest Ghost Town.